driving through the darkness, hungover and cautious, broken hearted boy. Yeah, that's how it started, with the dead asking why you don't compare. Father St. Francis, your daddy's in a casket. You hear it in the wind, but she don't wanna ask you. You see it in her mouth, you see it in her hands, and you know you got a secret that you'll never understand. And the ghosts say what you already know.
Welcome back. You are listening to The Mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts. And this is your host, Andrew Lewis. If you're just joining us for the first time, this is a Shaggy Dog story. It's about an artist in San Diego, an installation in a Catholic church in San Diego County in the 1990s. It's about the gospel, and lots of God stuff, and lots of stories about San Diego at the cusp of the end of the last century. So if you're into any of that, or if you're not, I encourage you to stick around and listen for more. Today, I have to start off a little bit with some stuff I've been thinking about language. I recently had the great fortune of being in Hawaii, in Honolulu, last week, and it got me thinking about the nature of the English language and how it's one of its great superpowers is that it absorbs everything. It just hoovers up any language it comes into contact with. The roots of the English language are incredibly varied. It's absorbed French and Celtic and German and Norse, and it has its roots in Indo-European, but it's also absorbed words and ideas from all of the Romance languages and from further afield in India and Africa and Asia. And it's this great capacity to just absorb everything that gives the language its tremendous strength, that the language doesn't become weaker by absorbing all of these other things. It actually becomes stronger. Its capacity to understand, its capacity to communicate is strengthened. And that's what makes the English language at this moment the lingua franca of the entire world. It's the language that people use to communicate in business and technology. If a businessman from, let's say, Germany is meeting with someone from China, they'll most likely broker their deal in English. It has that incredible strength. So something to think about. But also what's interesting is even though it can absorb all of these things, it does so imperfectly. So for example, I was in Hawaii, and there are lots of, or at least some Hawaiian words that we know. For example, aloha, right? And so most of us might think, oh, aloha, it means hello. Well, it can also be used when parting from someone. So when you're leaving, you don't say goodbye, you also say aloha, right? But aloha is not really hello or goodbye. It's something greater. It means let us be present with one another in our best self. Let us bring joy into this moment. It's not, I hope that you're joyful in this moment. It's more of a collaborative act that we will be present in this moment together in a state of well-being. And that we're, by saying aloha, we're inviting that well-being into this moment that you and I share. As well, for example, there's another Hawaiian word, aina, which somehow some of you may be familiar with. And oftentimes, or sometimes you might hear in Hawaii, someone say aloha aina, right? Well, aina is, we translate it as the word for land, but ai means to feed or to nourish. And the land isn't just an inanimate object, it's a being. It almost, and some might even say it's a sentient being. And so aina is actually that great being, that great thing that nourishes us, that sustains us. And when we say aloha aina, we're not greeting that being. We're bringing ourselves in a state of wellness and wholeness to be present with that thing that nourishes and sustains us. Now, of course, in English, we just translate these things as hello and land, and we completely miss these greater, more significant, more interesting sentiments. And it suggests also the way that other languages can communicate things that are beyond the range, perhaps, of our own culture or perhaps the language that we inhabit. So another thing for you to think about. And I also can't help but mention perhaps the most memorable moment that I had in Honolulu. I had the incredible fortune of, at the very last minute, being able to secure a ticket to go visit the Doris Duke home on the other side of Diamond Head. It's called Shangri-La, which is interesting in its own right. Doris Duke was the heiress to the Duke tobacco fortune. And when she was alive, she was basically the richest woman in the entire world. Her fortune, I think in today's dollars, was somewhere around $4.3 billion. Whatever she wanted, she could have. She could simply possess it. She could purchase it. She, very interesting woman, very complicated woman, very complicated life. But as when she was young, very early on, she traveled to the Middle East, to the Islamic world, and she became intoxicated by it, just smitten. She wasn't necessarily sure what she was looking at, what she was seeing necessarily, but she saw it as being incredibly beautiful, profoundly beautiful. Islamic culture draws from Persia and the Arabic world and from India, encompasses all sorts of cultures. And right away, she wanted to possess this. She wanted to bring it into herself. And of course, for a person of her time and her stature, the way you did that was you bought things. So she literally traveled throughout the Islamic world, through Persia, through Iran, through Iraq, through Saudi Arabia, and she just bought what she could. She bought Moroccan tiled boxes. She bought entire walls of tile work. She took things out of mosques. She secured whatever she could, fabrics, tile, any sort of artifact. And she brought this stuff back to Hawaii, and she built a home there as a place to display these things that she had found and these things that had so inspired her. Unfortunately, partly out of ignorance, partly out of perhaps just lack of knowledge on behalf of the people who she was working with, a lot of the tile work, beautiful as it was installed improperly. She took, for example, a marab, I believe from Isfahan in Iran, and this is a portal. It's actually, the marab points in the direction of Mecca. It's actually a portal toward Mecca. It's sort of a gateway. And when she had it installed in Shangri-La, she, of course, didn't install it directionally, correctly. It was not facing towards Mecca. And the people who installed it had put the tiles in the wrong places. And so some of these tiles included inscriptions from the Quran. They were the literal word of Allah. And when they were installed incorrectly, it took the word of God and it just rendered it into a kind of gibberish. I think for people from the Islamic world who have visited the Doris Duke home, they've found it deeply disturbing. And of course, this is something which over time perhaps will one day be remedied. But there was something even more profound that struck me. And literally, I felt the ground almost falling away as I stood in these rooms. Because at this moment, we're bombing the places where these artifacts came. We're destroying them. In fact, Isfahan, which is a World Heritage Site, a UNESCO World Heritage Site, has already sustained damage, including the mosques from which she took this tile work. And so it very well may be that as inaccurately and clumsily as this stuff has been transported out of Iran, that this small home in Hawaii may be the last refuge for some of this, the greatest artistry that humans have ever created. So why do I tell you this? Maybe just as an acknowledgement of this terribly sad moment that we're living within, perhaps as my own quiet way to summon mercy, just mercy on all sides. Because mercy is probably the one thing that our world is sorely, sorely in need of in this moment.
Long faded, and I stood where heroes have fallen, their names turned to stone. Yet I remain nameless, the best friend a hero has known. And now I'm saving my strength for running. These days I'm saving my strength for running. From the age of kings, when pride decided all fate, long before war machines took charge and I was to wait. If the blind hope and blinders of young men to carry between, all the death and the glory, believing they're one and the same. And now I'm saving my strength for running. These days I'm saving my strength for running. I've carried the world on my back, no more to obtain. The sword and the shield perched upon saddles and reins. But the stampedes of thunder, the cavalry's charge, leave me now. Your last war will come, but I cannot follow you down. No, I'm saving my strength for running. These days I'm saving my strength for running. I said these days I'm saving my strength for running.
Mercy. What is this quality that we call mercy? A few weeks ago, quite unexpectedly, I began to tell you the story of Shahrazad, that great temptress and storyteller who seduced a king in order to keep him from destroying his entire kingdom. And Shahrazad had begun by telling him the story of the merchant and the jinn. Basically, a merchant went traveling to trade, and on his return home, he had stopped to take a repast, his afternoon lunch, and as he did so, he had eaten some dates, and he had cast or flicked the pit of a date onto the ground, and quite unbeknownst to him, he had struck the son of a great genie in the eye and had killed him. And so the genie appeared and he stated that he would take the merchant's life blood for blood because he had taken the life of his son. And the merchant, he had begged for mercy. He had begged to be spared. And so as the genie was about to bring his sword down upon the merchant and take his life from him, he said, the merchant entreated the genie. He said, please, please, allow me just to go home, to say goodbye to my family, to my children, to my wife. Allow me to divide my property. Please allow me to do this and do not kill me. And the genie, of course, he had to listen to this because this was a request before God, asking the genie to abide by the precepts of God, that a man should be allowed to say goodbye to his loved ones before his death, before his parting from this mortal world. And so the genie listened and he said, well, if I let you go, I can give you time. You won't come back. And then the merchant said, God is my witness. I shall return. And the genie asked how long it would be. And the merchant said, well, to fill all of these objectives, to part with my family, to say goodbye to my wife, to fulfill my duties in this mortal world, it will take me a year. And then he swore to God, and he swore to the genie on his life that he would return. And given that the merchant had given his word, the genie released him. And the merchant mounted his horse and he rode the long way back to his home. And when he arrived there, he was in tears, and his family, his wife, asked, why are you so sad? And he said, would you too not be sad if you had only 1 year left on this earth to live? And at hearing this and hearing the tale from the merchant of what had befallen him, the family, they themselves were saddened, all his sons and his daughters and his wife, and they all fell to weeping. But they gathered themselves, and over the course of the year, the merchant fulfilled his promise. He divided his earthly possessions. He gave alms to the poor. He read from the Quran. He summoned his witnesses and friends, and he bid farewell to them. He gave to his older children their share of their wealth. And when the year had gone by, the merchant bid goodbye to everyone. And with his heart grieving, saddened heart, he left. And he said, everyone, this was God's design. It is the design, God's design, that all people shall die. And so he mounted his horse and he journeyed day and night, and he returned to the place of the genie, and with a heavy heart he sat to wait for the genie to come and to take his life from him. But as he waited, an old man approached, and he had a doe, a female deer, on a chain. And he greeted the merchant, and the merchant greeted him back, Assalamu alaikum, Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you. And he asked, why do you sit here alone in this barren place? And the merchant told his tale, and he told of what would soon befall him. And the old man, in wonder, he said, I will not leave you, he said, until I see what happens with the genie. And he sat by him to talk. And as they spoke, and then the day broke, and Shahrazad said, it is time now for us to sleep. It is time now for us to rest. And Shahrazad's sister was there with her, Duryodhan, and she said, what a strange and wondrous tale. And Shahrazad said, I have so many more wondrous things to tell you. If you allow me one more night to live. And the king, the caliph, he said, yes, you can live one more night. I so much want to hear what you have to tell.
I dug up a diamond, rare and fine. I dug up a diamond in a deep dark mine. If only I could cling to my beautiful fire. I dug up a diamond in a deep dark mine. My gem is special beyond all words, strong as any metal, a stone in the earth, sharp as any razor, a blade you can buy, bright as any laser or any star in the sky. Maybe once in a lifetime, you'll hold one in your hand. Once in a lifetime, in this land, where the journey ends in a worthless claim. Time and again, in a mining. Up a diamond, rare and fine. I dug up a diamond in a deep dark mine. Down in the darkness, in the dirt and the grime, I dug up a diamond in a deep dark mine.
Welcome back. You are listening to The Mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts. Well, I'm glad you're here. We have a lot of ground to cover, and it would be terrible to do it all alone. So where do we start? We could start in the year 828, when a ship arrived in the port of Alexandria in Egypt. The ship had traveled across the Mediterranean, and the ship's standard signaled that it had traveled across the sea from Venice, and it bore upon its deck two merchants. Or we could start 800 years earlier, within a half century of the Lord's death, when the apostles' lots were cast across the face of the earth. It was said that Mark was called by the Holy Spirit to Alexandria, and that he was to go to the great lighthouse, and from there to spread the word of God. Upon arriving in the city, Mark's sandal broke, and it was mended by a cobbler who pierced his hand with a needle, and the wound was healed by spit and clay that Mark applied to the cobbler's hand. Mark blessed the home of the cobbler, and he introduced himself as a slave of the Lord Jesus Christ, the Son of God. And he related the gospel of the Christ to the cobbler, who, though schooled in the Grecian literature, had no knowledge of the man of whom Mark spoke. Over the next 2 years, the multitude supposedly came to hear the preachings of Mark. Mark would be arrested at the Passover, a rope fastened to his neck and his body dragged through the streets, and even as his blood stained the stones, Mark uttered his thanks to his Lord. And so they dragged him and tortured his flesh until his eyes shuddered and his spirit was released. They then attempted to burn his body, but the body of the evangelist would not burn, and his corpse would be laid to rest on the 17th of Nisan in the great city of Alexandria. And there it would remain. That is, until the day in 828, when a ship arrived in the port. The two Venetian merchants it carried learned that the Muslim infidels were to destroy the church of St. Mark, and they petitioned the Greek priest to release the relics of Mark unto them. The merchants concealed the remains of Mark in slabs of pork so that they would not be discovered by the Muslim custom officers, and his relics were smuggled out and carried across the water. And that is how the bones of Saint Mark, the lion guarding the desert, were bestowed upon the city-state of Venice. Certainly stranger things have happened. John Brockley had access to lions. We all lived, after all, just a few miles away from the San Diego Zoo. At any time, he could have gone there and observed the large felines sleeping in their enclosures. Instead, he worked from old photographs. As he limned out the forms that he would eventually project onto the panel that would hang on the left side of the proscenium arch, he drew from black and whites from old naturalist texts. He shadowed in the bones of the brow and forehead of the lion. The hair of the mane feels dirty and naturalistic, the eyes deep black wells. It feels as if it were watercolored with blacks and gray and umber. The ears, and above, a halo, a shadow of an ear. Later, congregants at the Church of St. Elizabeth Seton would be troubled by the image, suggesting that it looked half-finished. In 1956, when my mother was cast from her family, when in her mid-20s she left her home, an apartment in Cleveland that would end up being just one of many way stations in her life, she took a greyhound across the plains, and she made her way to Denver, where she would live with a childhood friend that she had met in the displaced persons camps of Europe. She would spend her afternoons at the Denver Zoo. She'd stand at the iron cages and watch the lions pace back and forth. No place to range, no place to hunt, no young to feed, no coupling with whom to mate. The lions were left with nothing but mindless pacing. My mother would talk to the lions. She would whisper to them for want of them being free. There's a story that was told of how she once went to the circus and found her way to the back lot. She introduced herself to the lion tamers. She had a way, she said, with cats. Perhaps they could use an assistant, someone fearless, someone who could help them tame the lions. An autographed picture of a man with a whip before the large cats would be tucked in a drawer in her house for years, inviting speculation. 1974, the neighborhood of Mission Hills in San Diego. Our father had died. Our mother now had two boys and was shattered. She simply didn't have the mind for it, for any of it, for cleaning the house, for dinners and breakfast, for caring for her children. So instead, she would wait in her room for my brother and I to go off to school, and then she would sneak away to the zoo. It was a place for her to go, a place where her presence would not invite questions. She would walk up and down the steep rivers of asphalt and pause before the lion and tiger enclosures and talk to the sleeping beasts. These were not lions or large cats to roar or yowl. I don't know if I ever heard them vocalize. And why would they? What would they have had to say of their impoverished lives? And then, one autumn, somehow, she took to walking the roads that ended on the lip of one of the canyons near our home. She must have even ventured into that overgrown place where few went. But down there, one morning, she saw the cats, several of them, cats that had gone feral and now live wild, hunting as cats in the canyon. And she decided she would tame them. The next day, she brought cans of Friskies to the canyon and opened them and scooped the food onto a paper plate and set the food a few feet in front of her. She would call for the cats and wait for them to come, but they kept their distance. And so she went to animal control. How she did it, I don't know, but somehow she convinced them to lend her traps for capturing large creatures. She took the traps to the canyon. These canyons were not her place. They were the roaming ground for children, but no place for adults. She picked her way down the trail deep into the wild chaparral overshadowed by towering eucalyptus. She set the cages and baited them with cat food. At dusk, she returned to discover that she had caught two of them. She struggled to carry the heavy crates containing the clawing, yowling cats out of the canyon. At home, she donned a heavy coat and cotton garden gloves. She opened the crate and tried to remove the cat from the cage, but it clawed and bit her arms to shreds. She later came down with a fever that left her in her darkened room for weeks.
Love is the key, and under the stars I lit a flame to dance in the dark. Could break my bones, could break my heart, but you'll never break me. Love is the ocean, we are the fish, love's the surgeon and we are the stitch. I've been wounded, but I promise you this, you will never break me. Yeah. on the cross. Angels are weeping, their tears are for us. The loss of our kindness comes at a cost. Let's fall in love with our telephones off. Love's my president, my lord, and my boss, and he'll never break me. Love is my president, my lord, my boss, and you'll never.
'91, Golden Hill. John was applying layers of parchment to smooth painted boards. And meanwhile, my girlfriend and I had settled into our apartment on A Street. It was the spring just after my mother had died. Before dawn, we awoke to a plaintive mewing. I walked on to the deck, and across the yard I saw a crying amber-colored kitten perched on the fence. I walked down the stairs in my pajamas and retrieved him and crawled back in bed and tucked him in the crook of my arm. He was our first cat. He would sleep nestled in my arm or flat on his back with his paws resting above the blanket, just like a person. We named him Lizzie. He grew up, and we had our daily routine. Each morning after Anna had gone to work at Harcourt Brace Publishing, I would walk down the stairs to water and work in the garden, and Lizzie would follow me down just at the nip of my heels. He would stay with me while I worked in the yard, lolling in the shade of the squash and green beans. And then he would follow me back upstairs. And when I napped, he would curl up, tucked in the crook of my arm. I was 25 and I had no parents, and I felt that the kitten would hold me in the sadness that would engulf me at times in the year after my mother's death. The old man next door, however, would be angry because he thought Lizzie would shit beneath his bushes. He would throw things at Lizzie and spray him with a hose. We went away once for a trip, and a friend looked after the apartment. But while we were gone, our friend found Lizzie one morning, dead and prone on our porch. He had frothing at his mouth. He had been killed with rat poison. After that, when we passed our next-door neighbor as we walked up the driveway, he wouldn't speak or even look in our direction. Why do I tell you this? Because the lion and all his relations are both predator and guardian. The lion wandered from the wilderness and emerged into the desert. The grain, those kernels of wheat that would germinate in the spring and that would feed civilizations, that grain that was the progenitor of all life, the great golden wealth of Egypt, would be stored in granaries. And the granaries would be pilfered and raided by mice and rats. The vermin would raid the tombs of the dormant and the dead. But the cats would catch the vermin. These hunters were the protectors of life. And so at the entrance to the Nile, at the base of the Great Pyramids, those symbolic granaries in which the bodies of Pharaoh, that human grain awaiting rebirth, would be stored, there the Sphinx was erected. The Sphinx was not the guardian of the dead, but was the guardian of future life. The lion was the guardian of resurrection. I can't remember exactly when or how he came to live across from us. In the upstairs apartment across the yard, a thin guy just kind of appeared. Young, wiry, his head more skull than face. He wore a black bandana tied tightly over his head. He often stood on his balcony, leaning on the gray stucco parapet, and he would gaze down quietly at the animals in our yard, pulling a drag on his cigarette. He had a large tabby cat, Tripper, that resembled ours. Unneutered, at night we would hear the cat yowling murder in the darkness. The man's name was Mark. Hardly in his 20s. It was 1991. We would soon learn that, like the quietly growing number among us, he had tested a positive. But that was the least of it. He was also in remission from testicular cancer. He was bald, we learned, because of his chemo. As he recovered, he came to us and showed off the peach fuzz of his hair as it grew back. In our minds, we counted his life in terms of months. But he moved forward as if his time on Earth was long. Mark trafficked in mid-century modern. He would find furnishings in thrift stores or yard sales, which he would purchase cheap. He'd refinish blonde dinette sets or cabinetry and resell them in shops on Adams Avenue or Park owned by his friends, or he'd drive it to the Rose Bowl flea market in Pasadena and sell it for 100 or even 1,000 times what he had paid for it. There was active trade in this stuff back then. The dying was becoming more frequent. I'm not sure people now can even imagine it. It wasn't just dying, but rather communities of death. Cluster after cluster of friends were being extinguished. Entire worlds of experience were going up in smoke. In 1990, AIDS was the leading cause of death for those in their 20s and 30s. In Golden Hill, estate sales were held every weekend, the fineries of the dead picked over in the neighborhood yards. Not infrequently, a train of men would visit Mark's apartment. Mark was getting better. All was going to be good, he told us. Mark also moved as if his time was unbearably short. One week, we didn't see him. I walked over to his place and up the concrete stairs and I knocked. It took some time for him to answer. Groggy, unshaven, and bent. His cancer had come back, he said. A few days earlier, the doctor had told him. That afternoon, Mark had left the doctor's office in Hillcrest. He drove himself straight to Logan, and he scored a fifth of vodka and a rock. He threw back the white alcohol and snorted the lines. He couldn't remember what happened next, only that he woke up in the dirty dawn, face down in his truck, his jaw busted up. He was parked under the semis roaring above on the I-94 overpass. From that moment on, Mark's life was one of fierce dispensation. On Christmas Day, he invited us to his apartment that smelled of dank. He buzzed with energy. He gave us a brushed aluminum canister with which we could dispense whipped cream, a glass vase from the 1950s that held an amaryllis. He gave us food, and we drank champagne. And we felt ashamed, because for him, we had brought nothing to give. One day, he knocked on our door. He had something for us. He didn't have the time to finish it, he said. It was a modern buffet for dishes, camel-colored wood, the varnish fading. It'll be easy to sand, he told us, and that we should re-varnish it. When you do that, this cabinet will be worth $1,000, he said, as if he was somehow hoping that we would carry on his life in his stead. We had no need for the buffet, but we took it anyway. We cut a hole in the back and used it as a stereo cabinet. Mark grew more thin. He moved away from the apartment to live with another friend who, as well, was dying. A few months later, Anna and I married. We had no way to find him. A few days after the wedding, we loaded our own car with the little we had, and we drove across the country to Boston and Philadelphia for graduate school. We would be returning in a year. We left behind nearly all of our furniture. A friend of ours came down from Seattle and moved into that apartment on A Street. She looked after our cats, Claire and Magellan. That winter, we called her to check in. The apartment was fine. Her parents would come frequently to visit and would stay over, and they too loved those sunlit rooms. The cats were doing good. The garden, though, had gone wild. "Oh, wait," she said. "There was something else," she said. "Some guy came by. He wasn't well. He wanted to know where you had gone. His name was Mark," she said. "He had come to say goodbye," he had said. That whipped cream canister, it sits in our kitchen cabinet now in Northern California. Sometimes our daughter, now grown, will pop in an O2 cartridge and will make whipped cream on a special occasion. As for the cabinet, we never refinished it. It became ever more worn. Years later, in a lapse of judgment, we left it on the curb, and when we came out in the morning, it had been taken.
Jesus Christ, I'm so blue all the time, and that's just how I feel. Always have, and I always will. Always have, and always will. Talk until we think we might just kill ourselves, but then we laugh until it disappears. And last night I blacked out in my car, and I woke up in my childhood bed, wishing I was someone else. remembered someone's kid is dead. Jesus Christ, I'm so blue all the time, and that's just how I feel, always have, and I always will, I always have, and always will. And it's 4 a.m. again,
You have been listening to The Mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts. Thank you for showing up and for giving us a chance to feel a little less alone for a little while. Today's songs opened with Francis by Haley Hendricks, followed by Cavalry by Watch House, Mark Knopfler and Emmylou Harris's I Dug Up a Diamond, Never Break by Langhorne Slim, Sweet Annie performed by Gillian Welch, and Funeral by Phoebe Bridgers. We'll be stepping out with Who Knows Where the Time Goes, an old standard sung by Sandy Denny with Fairport Convention. Denny herself would die too young at age 31. A special shout out to my friend Tom McKean, who introduced me to Fairport Convention so many years ago. If you're enjoying The Mountain, I encourage you to listen to the back episodes to get up on the story. You can find them on The Mountain page on the KOWS website, or you can find them on Spotify. Just search for The Mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts. If you want to stay abreast of all things Mountain, you can subscribe to The Mountain Substack page. Just Google The Mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts. It will be the best way to stay notified when next episodes drop, as well as to receive new kinds of content not available otherwise. And by all means, if you enjoyed the listen and it makes your world a little bigger, I would be grateful and indebted if you would share with your friends. Please have a great day or a good night wherever you are.
deserted shore. Your fickle friends are leaving. Ah, but then you know it's time for them to go. Until it's time to go.